Welcome to the deep dive, where we try to cut through the noise.
Get to the heart of what's really going on.
Exactly. Today, we're diving into a concept that, well, for decades, it's been seen as a cornerstone of American politics.
Mm-hmm.
Fiscal conservatism.
Mm-hmm. Prudence in government spending and debt.
Right. A bedrock principle, often tied to one political party in particular. But here's the question we're exploring, and it feels like a big one. Has this foundational principle actually been abandoned?
That's a really powerful question, and it's one that Jeff Bernard's detailed analysis really tackles head on. Our deep dive today is going to unpack how the Republican Party's fiscal policy shifted quite dramatically, actually, especially during the Trump administration.
Leading to record deficits.
Record deficits, yeah, and tax cuts that, as the data seems to show, disproportionately benefited the wealthy. Bernard's work really suggests that on fiscal matters, the party has, well, lost its traditional bearings in some pretty significant ways.
So our mission today is to really unpack this transformation. We're going to look at the history, specific policy decisions, the actual outcomes, what the numbers say, and maybe some of the political calculations behind it all.
Right. We want to help you understand the core arguments, the underlying figures, and really why these shifts matter for your future and, you know, the financial health of the country.
Okay, let's dig in. So when we talk about traditional fiscal conservatism, what are we actually talking about? What are the core ideas?
Well, at its heart, it's about prudence, right? In government spending and debt. It's rooted in ideas like capitalism, individualism, limited government.
Laissez-faire economics.
Exactly. So you'd expect to see calls for reduced spending, lower taxes, free markets, deregulation, privatization, free trade, and a really strong emphasis on minimal government debt, balanced budgets.
The government living within its means, like a household is supposed to.
That's the idea. Yeah. And it has this intellectual history, too. You mentioned Edmund Burke arguing against burdening future generations with debt.
But there's always been this, this tension, hasn't there? Even within that traditional view. It seems like a push-pull.
You've absolutely hit on it. Because while pushing for balanced budgets, the philosophy also champions tax cuts. And historically, fiscal conservatives have often, well, accepted more debt rather than raise taxes.
Especially if those tax cuts are framed as pro-growth.
Precisely. And then you have supply-side economics entering the picture, arguing that tax cuts could essentially pay for themselves through faster growth. The Laffer curve idea.
Yes, the Laffer curve. Lowering rates boosts revenue eventually.
That was the argument. It gave a powerful rationale for cutting taxes, even if it meant deficits in the short term. This kind of ideological flexibility is, I think, key to understanding how we got here.
That really sets the stage. Okay, let's look at the GOP's historical relationship with the budget. Early on, it was generally pro-business, right? Tariffs, infrastructure.
Yeah, but then you get to someone like Eisenhower. His era is often seen as a kind of benchmark for modern republicanism.
And he explicitly prioritized balancing the budget over cutting taxes.
He did. He actively restrained spending, even with Democrats controlling Congress. He achieved a balanced budget by 1960, used the veto pen. It was very much a results-oriented fiscal discipline, quite different from what we've seen more recently.
Okay, so that's one model. Now let's jump forward to a really pivotal shift. Reaganomics and supply-side theory.
Right. Lower marginal tax rates, deregulation, but also increased defense spending.
And the idea, again, was that the Laffer curve magic would make those tax cuts self-financing. That narrative was incredibly powerful at the time.
It really was, politically very attractive. But the actual fiscal outcome, well, it was dramatic. The national debt nearly tripled under Reagan.
Tripled.
Yeah, from about $738 billion to $2.1 trillion. The deficit as a percentage of GDP, it jumped from 2.5% in 81 to nearly 6%, 5.7% by 83. This wasn't just a blip. It fundamentally changed the debt trajectory.
And Reagan himself later called the debt his greatest disappointment.
He did, which is telling. But despite that, you then had the 1990s Republican Congress campaigning on deficit elimination.
And they actually did it. Balanced budget in fiscal 98, first time since the 60s.
It shows it was possible politically and economically. But then, fast forward again to the George W. Bush years, he inherited that projected $5.6 trillion surplus.
Which vanished pretty quickly.
Vanished and got replaced by record deficits, the key drivers. The big ones were the Bush tax cuts. CBO estimated they could add $1.5 to $3 trillion to the debt if extended. And of course, the deficit finance wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Those two alone accounted for something like $6 trillion in deficits later on.
Over $6 trillion, yeah. Just looking at the 2009-2019 period. And this established a really concerning pattern. Major debt increases during relative peacetime. Not like World War II. It signaled a systemic shift.
And then bubbling up around 2007-2010, you had the Tea Party movement.
Right. A really potent force demanding lower taxes, debt reduction, spending cuts. There was clearly an appetite among voters for fiscal discipline.
But as Jeff Bernard's analysis highlights, the Trump administration, while maybe using some of that anti-establishment language.
Right. They tapped into that energy.
The policies ended up going in the opposite direction on debt and deficits.
Exactly. The populist energy got channeled elsewhere, you could argue. Which brings us squarely to Trump's first term. Bernard argues this was a really decisive break from tradition.
And the numbers, they are pretty staggering.
They really are. During his term, President Trump approved policies adding up to $8.4 trillion in new 10-year borrowing.
$8.4 trillion. It's hard to even picture that.
It's immense. That includes nearly $6 trillion in net spending increases and another $2.5 trillion in net tax cuts. The result? Debt held by the public surged 39%. It went from just under $20 trillion to almost $28 trillion.
And crucially, this wasn't just because of the pandemic, right? The trend was already there.
That's a critical point. Even before COVID hit, the annual federal budget deficit had already jumped by almost 50%. It went from $585 billion in 2016 to nearly $1,984 billion by 2019. Yeah. And the growth in the annual deficit relative to the size of the economy under Trump was the third biggest increase ever, only behind George W. Bush and Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War.
So the fiscal position was already getting much worse before the pandemic emergency spending.
Absolutely. Deficits hit 4% of GDP in 2018, 4.6% in 2019, higher than CBO projected. This deterioration was largely a deliberate policy choice, driven by the 2017 tax cuts and spending increases. It basically wiped out any fiscal margin for error before the crisis hit.
Okay, let's talk about those tax cuts. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017, the TCJA, that was the centerpiece.
It really was a huge partisan reform. Most famously, it slashed the corporate tax rate from 35% down to 21%.
And what did the CBO, the nonpartisan scorekeeper, say about its effect on the deficit?
Their estimate was that the TCJA alone would add about $1.9 trillion to deficits over 11 years. Or closer to $2.3 trillion if you include the extra interest costs on the debt.
A key part of that was that many of the individual tax cuts were temporary, set to expire.
Exactly. They expire at the end of 2025. If those get extended, which is often what happens politically.
Right, they almost always do.
The CBO and other analysts project it could add potentially trillions more to the debt over the long term. Some estimates are as high as $37 trillion over 30 years. It's a massive overhang.
Beyond the TCJA, there were other spending drivers, too. Bipartisan budget deals.
Yes, the Bipartisan Budget Acts of 2018 and 2019 added another $2.1 trillion or so to the projected debt. And then, of course, came the initial COVID relief, like the CARES Act. Those were huge, necessary, and importantly, bipartisan efforts.
But the point Jeff Bernard makes is key. The starting point mattered.
Precisely. While the COVID relief spending was bipartisan, the underlying fiscal weakness that was already there before the pandemic, largely thanks to the TCJA, meant the U.S. went into that crisis with much less fiscal breathing room. The pre-existing conditions, fiscally speaking, were not good.
So you have this contrast. On one hand, Trump campaigned pledging to eliminate the national debt in 8 years. On the other, the debt rose almost $7.8 trillion during his term. The annual deficit up nearly 50% by 2019, pre-pandemic. And then the administration's own budget office blamed Congress for the ballooning debt.
Yeah, that rhetorical disconnect is just striking. And it's central, I think, to understanding how supporters might have, misinterpreted the situation. They heard the familiar talk about fiscal responsibility.
Words they expected to hear.
Right. But the actual policies and the outcomes went in a very different direction. And that blame shifting, pointing the finger at Congress, just further clouds the picture.
This brings us to the whole trickle-down idea and its outcomes. You hear that term a lot, but it's more of a political label than a formal economic theory, isn't it?
Exactly. It's not something most economists use as a technical term. It's more of a descriptor, often used critically, for policies that give give direct financial benefits, usually tax cuts, to corporations and wealthy individuals.
But with the premise being that these benefits will eventually trickle down to everyone else, stimulate broader growth.
That's the premise, yes. It serves as a rhetorical device to legitimize policies that might seem heavily skewed towards the top. By framing them as ultimately beneficial for all, it can obscure the potential for increased inequality.
So what does the actual evidence say about the TCJA? Who really benefited? Let's start with growth and jobs.
Well, there was a pretty comprehensive study out of the London School of Economics, the LSE, in December 2020. They looked back at 5 decades of tax cuts across 18 wealthy nations.
Okay, what did they find?
They found that major tax cuts for the rich consistently benefited the rich, but had, quote, no meaningful effect on unemployment or economic growth. The impact on GDP per capita and unemployment rates, statistically indistinguishable from zero.
Zero effect on growth or jobs. That directly contradicts the main selling point.
It certainly challenges it very strongly.
And what about the distribution? Who got the money?
The same LSE study concluded that these kinds of tax reforms consistently lead to higher income inequality. Specifically, they increased the share of national income going to the top 1%.
Other studies found similar things.
Yes. Research from the Oxford Academic Socioeconomic Review looked specifically at the TCJA. They found some efficiency gains for companies, more investment, profits, things like that. But at the same time, an increase in inequality.
How did it break down?
Roughly half the gains went to corporate shareholders. The other half went to highly paid workers and executives. But for workers below the 90th percentile, so most people, the effects on their earnings were, again, statistically indistinguishable from zero.
So the benefits were really concentrated at the very top. This sounds like that classic efficiency-equity trade-off.
That's exactly the term economists use. The policy might boost some economic activity, create efficiency, but it also makes the distribution of income, the equity, more unequal.
And the public discourse often emphasized the efficiency part.
Right, the potential for investment and growth.
While maybe downplaying the equity implications, the fact that most people weren't seeing much direct benefit.
Precisely. And that selective emphasis helps explain how supporters could view the policy positively, focusing on the potential upsides while overlooking the distributional consequences and the mounting debt.
But there was also that Federal Reserve study showing a more nuanced picture for some households, people reporting feeling more comfortable financially.
Yes, and that's an important piece. The Fed study found that survey respondents who got larger personal income tax cuts were modestly more likely to report living comfortably. They were also a bit more likely to open new credit accounts.
So for some individuals, there was a real felt benefit.
There was. And this psychological dimension is key. If you personally feel a bit better off, even if the aggregate data shows rising inequality and debt, that personal experience can create a disconnect. It makes it easier to believe the policy was broadly successful.
Okay, and one last point on this. The idea that tax cuts pay for themselves, does the evidence ever support that?
Very rarely, if ever, in practice for broad-based cuts like these. You can look back at the early 2000s, for example. From 2001 to 2007, the Treasury actually collected $2.6 trillion less in revenue than the CBO had projected back in 2001, despite tax cuts being implemented.
So the promised revenue surge just didn't happen.
It didn't. And the CBO's projections for the TCJA also consistently showed it would add significantly to the debt. The idea that major tax cuts fully pay for themselves through growth is largely a fallacy, according to the evidence. It's a politically convenient argument, but the numbers don't back it up.
Okay, so that was Trump's first term. Now, looking ahead, there's this proposed one big beautiful bill, H.R. 1. This sounds like basically doubling down on that trajectory.
It very much looks like a continuation, even an acceleration of that fiscal path. The stated goals are familiar: driving massive economic growth, unleashing American energy, strengthening border security and national defense.
And the core of it is extending those expiring 2017 tax cuts.
That's a huge part of it, yes, extending and modifying them. But it also includes significant spending changes, new work requirements for Medicaid and SNAP.
Cutting health benefits and food assistance.
Right, and proposing hundreds of billions in cuts to things like education spending and green energy subsidies.
But like before, it's not all cuts, is it? There's new spending in there, too.
Exactly. It's a reallocation. Big increases proposed for border security, $10 billion in grants, money for Operation Stone Garden, plus military enhancements. And interestingly, specific funds earmarked for the FIFA World Cup and the Olympics.
Billions for sporting events alongside cuts to social programs. And what do the CBO projections say about this bill's impact on deficits?
They're stark. The Senate version is projected to add $3.4 trillion to deficits over 10 years. The House version, $2.4 trillion, mostly because it assumes a massive $3.67 trillion drop in expected revenues from extending the tax cuts.
So even if proponents argue it boosts the economy.
Right. They talk about potential economic effects, reducing the primary deficit slightly, maybe $85, $100 billion. But here's the catch. Those gains, even if they materialize, are completely swamped by the increased interest payments on the already huge national debt.
Because the debt itself is so much bigger now.
Precisely. So the net effect, according to CBO, is that the bill increases debt held by the public to 124% of GDP by 2034. That's up from the baseline projection of 117%. It accelerates the debt climb because of compounding interest.
So it's presented as pro-growth, but the math shows it adds significantly to the debt burden. It really highlights that this isn't just a deficit reduction plan.
Not at all. It's a strategic reallocation. Cut social safety nets, cut clean energy areas traditional conservatives target, but then pour money into populist nationals' priorities like the border and military. It shows a clear shift away from across-the-board spending cuts toward funding specific political goals, even if it blows up the deficit.
And this hasn't gone unnoticed, even within the Republican Party. There's been dissent from traditional fiscal hawks.
Oh, yes. People like Representative Chip Roy, Senator Ron Johnson, they've been sharply critical. They argue the proposed spending cuts are too small, the savings are illusory, and the whole thing is, quote, deficit busting.
Senator Johnson explicitly said he couldn't support it as discussed because it would add to the debt.
He did. And that kind of public opposition from within the party really underscores how far the Trumpian approach has diverged from those older fiscal conservative principles. It reveals a real conflict over the party's identity and suggests the traditional fiscal hawks are, well, maybe losing influence.
And all these policy choices, they don't happen in isolation. They feed into broader macroeconomic pressures. We've seen warning signs, like the U.S. credit rating downgrades.
That's a really big one. For the first time ever, all three major rating agencies, S&P, Fitch, and now Moody's, just recently in 2025, have downgraded the U.S. sovereign credit rating from their top tier.
And the reasons they cite are consistent.
Very consistent. Unsustainable deficits, accelerating debt, and persistent political gridlock, making it hard to address the problem. Moody's specifically pointed to the failure of successive U.S. administrations and Congress to reverse the trend. By the time Moody's downgraded, the national debt was already at 100% of GDP by their measure.
And this isn't just some abstract number for Wall Street, right? This has real-world consequences for people.
Absolutely. These downgrades mean higher borrowing costs for the U.S. government, and that eventually trickles down to you. It means potentially higher interest rates on your mortgage, your car loan, the loans businesses take out to expand. It makes everything more expensive.
And another factor adding pressure was the use of tariffs during the Trump administration. That fueled inflation.
It definitely contributed. Those sweeping tariffs, 10% on almost all imports, 30% on goods from China, directly pushed up the cost of imported goods. Things like furniture, clothing, appliances, even groceries like orange juice.
So consumers felt that directly.
Yes. Inflation ticked up. Some economists projected those tariffs alone could add 3 to 5% to the inflation rate, potentially pushing overall inflation towards 8%. David Brooks called the tariffs literally the dumbest domestic policy of my lifetime, warning about higher car prices and supply chain chaos. It highlights this trade-off between protectionism and price stability, and it wasn't exactly fiscally conservative either.
Okay, and the third compounding crisis. Rising interest rates and the sheer cost of servicing the national debt.
Yeah, the debt level is huge, close to World War II levels as a share of the economy, but arguably harder to manage now because of built-in obligations like Medicare and Social Security.
And financing that debt has gotten much more expensive recently.
Dramatically so since 2021 as interest rates rose. Those interest payments have ballooned. They now consume about 18% of all federal revenue. Get this. Interest payments now cost more than the entire defense budget and more than Medicare spending.
More than defense and more than Medicare. Wow.
And it's projected to keep growing, crowding out other potential investments. Which makes President Trump's renewed call for the Fed to slash rates down to 1% seem, well,
problematic.
Economists warn it would look like a panic move, risk reigniting inflation, undermine the Fed's credibility, and potentially spook the bond market. It highlights this real tension between wanting cheaper borrowing for the government and maintaining sound monetary policy.
So pulling this together, why? Why did the GOP, according to Bernard's analysis and the data we've discussed, move so far away from traditional fiscal conservatism? What was the political calculus?
Well, a few things seem clear. First, a deliberate prioritization of large tax cuts, like the TCJA, over actually controlling the resulting deficits or finding corresponding spending cuts. It seems like a political bet that tax cuts are popular, even if they mostly benefit the wealthy and add to the debt.
And redefining what counts as conservative spending.
Exactly. A willingness to spend big on specific areas, border security, military, even some social programs favored by the base that align with a more populist or nationalist agenda, rather than sticking to strict, limited government principles across the board.
Plus, that tax cuts pay for themselves narrative, even if inaccurate, remains politically potent.
Incredibly potent. It offers the promise of benefits without the pain of unpopular spending cuts. It creates this useful illusion of fiscal responsibility. And then there's the co-option of anti-establishment rhetoric.
Tapping into that Tea Party energy you mentioned earlier.
Right. Adopting some of the language of being anti-debt, anti-establishment, even while pursuing policies that actually increase the debt significantly, it allowed a departure from fiscal orthodoxy without necessarily alienating large parts of the base who were perhaps more motivated by cultural or nationalist issues.
The America First agenda kind of reframed spending priorities too.
Absolutely. Things like tariffs, military buildup, border spending, these were framed as necessary investments for national strength, making the associated costs or debt seem more justifiable to supporters than, say, spending on traditional social programs. It's about prioritizing perceived national interest over free markets or strict fiscal limits.
And as you said, the traditional fiscal hawks within the party just don't seem to have the same influence anymore.
The dissent is noted, but the fact that legislation like H.R. 1 could advance despite their warnings suggests their concerns are no longer decisive. It signals a real ideological shift within the party.
And this shift has really profound implications, not just politically, but for conservative philosophy itself.
It really does. That massive increase in debt and the overall expansion of federal spending directly challenge the core conservative principle of limited government.
And what about intergenerational equity? That Brookian idea of not burdening the future.
It directly contradicts it. Piling up trillions in debt that future generations will have to pay interest on or repay entirely is the definition of shifting the cost of today's policies onto the future. And the embrace of tariffs and subsidies also marks a deviation from pure free market, laissez-faire principles. It's a more interventionist approach.
Okay, let's talk brass tacks. The long-term economic consequences. What are the biggest worries?
Well, persistently high and rising debt can dampen long-term growth. It leads to higher borrowing costs. It can crowd out private investment as government borrowing sucks up available capital. The CBO actually projects that just extending the TCJA tax cuts could shrink the economy by nearly 2% by 2054 compared to letting them expire.
And those escalating debt service costs we talked about.
They're a huge drain, eating up 18% of revenue, more than defense or Medicare. That's money that can't go to infrastructure, education, research, things that boost long-term potential. It also reduces fiscal flexibility.
Meaning it's harder to respond to the next crisis.
Exactly. If you're already heavily indebted, your capacity to respond effectively to a recession, a pandemic, a national security threat, without making the fiscal situation even worse, is severely constrained.
And what about internationally? Our standing.
Those credit downgrades aren't just symbolic. Repeated downgrades and a perception of fiscal indiscipline could, over time, erode international trust in U.S. debt and potentially challenge the dollar status as the world's main reserve currency. That status gives us huge advantages.
Advantages like lower borrowing costs.
Right. But those advantages rest on trust and credibility. If that erodes due to runaway debt and political dysfunction, it could lead to permanently higher borrowing costs and diminish America's influence on the world stage.
So if we zoom out and look at the U.S. fiscal situation compared to other major countries, how do we actually stack up? Our debt to GDP ratio, for instance.
It's high. In 2023, our general government debt was about 123% of GDP. That puts us near the very top among large advanced economies. Only Japan and Italy were higher.
And it's projected to keep rising.
Yes, potentially hitting 130% by 2030. And what's really striking, as we mentioned, is that this is happening during relative peacetime. Historically, debt surges like this were tied to massive events like World War II when it hit 150%. Now it seems like a permanent upward trend.
A new regime, as some call it. What about our annual deficits compared to others?
We consistently run some of the largest deficits among advanced economies. For 2025, the U.S. deficit is projected around 6.5% of GDP. That's the highest in the G7.
How do others manage it differently, countries like Switzerland or South Korea?
They often have stricter fiscal rules, different spending priorities, and manage to keep their primary budgets, that's the budget before interest payments, closer to balance.
So is our problem primarily that we spend too much compared to others or that we tax too little?
That's a really crucial question. And the data suggests it's primarily a revenue issue. The U.S. actually collects a smaller share of its GDP in taxes, about 31%, than most other major advanced economies, except maybe South Korea.
So we tax less.
Right.
But do we spend less too?
Interestingly, yes. We also allocate a smaller share of our GDP to government spending than almost all our developed peers, again, except South Korea and Switzerland.
So the takeaway is?
The takeaway is that the U.S. deficit problem isn't mainly because our government spending is exceptionally high compared to other rich countries. It's more that our revenue collection is too low relative to the spending commitments we have made. We don't bring in enough money to cover even our comparatively lower level of spending.
And those interest payments, again, they really stand out internationally.
They absolutely do. In 2023, the U.S. spent 3.9% of its GDP just on interest payments. That was more than any other major advanced economy. It's a direct result of all that accumulated debt combined with the recent rise in interest rates. Our borrowing costs are just higher.
So we do have these unique advantages, the dollar being the reserve currency, deep financial markets.
Which helps us borrow more cheaply than we otherwise could.
But those advantages aren't guaranteed forever.
No, they rely fundamentally on trust and credibility. A sustained trend of rising debt, combined with political gridlock that prevents solutions, could seriously test that foundation. It's a risk with potentially huge long-term consequences if that trust erodes.
So let's recap. We've walked through Jeff Bernard's analysis and a lot of data showing how the Republican Party, especially under Trump, really shifted away from its traditional fiscal conservatism.
A decisive move, prioritizing big tax cuts and specific spending hikes over balanced budgets, leading to unprecedented peacetime debt accumulation. It's fundamentally changed the party's fiscal posture.
And we've talked about how this shift was often presented in ways that might lead supporters to, well, misinterpret the facts.
Right. That persistent, alluring tax cuts pay for themselves narrative, despite the evidence. The selective focus on potential efficiency gains while downplaying or ignoring the reality of increased inequality.
And co-opting the language of fiscal hawks, like the Tea Party, while enacting policies that went against their core demands for debt reduction.
Exactly. Plus, highlighting any subjective sense of improved financial well-being for some individuals, which can mask the larger negative trends in aggregate data, like national debt or inequality.
And finally, reframing debt accumulation as maybe a necessary cost for achieving other goals, like an America First agenda or building big, beautiful things, rather than as a fiscal burden in itself.
It's a powerful combination of rhetoric and policy shifts that has allowed the party to move quite far from its historical fiscal principles, reshaping what is considered acceptable within that political movement.
We've seen how this can ripple out and affect everything from your mortgage rates to grocery prices. So the final thought for you, our listener, what does this deep dive into the GOP's fiscal transformation mean for your understanding of political rhetoric versus economic reality? And maybe more importantly, as citizens, what questions should we all be asking, regardless of party, about the long-term financial health of our country?